The Holy Gospel according to St. Luke, the 20th chapter. Jesus began to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard and leased it to tenants and went to another country for a long time. When the season came, he sent a slave to the tenants in order that they might give him his share of the produce of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Next, he sent another slave. That one also they beat and insulted and sent away empty-handed. And he sent still a third. This one also they wounded and threw out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my beloved son. Perhaps they will respect him." But when the tenants saw him, they discussed it among themselves and said, "This is their heir. Let us kill him so that the inheritance may be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, "Heaven forbid." But Jesus looked at them and said, "What then does this text mean? The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and it will crush anyone on whom it falls." When the scribes and the chief priests realized that he had told this parable against them, they wanted to lay their hands on him at that very hour, but they feared the people. So they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be honest in order to trap him by what he said, so as to hand him over to the jurisdiction and authority of the governor. The Gospel of the Lord. On this St. Patrick's Day, let's start with some Irish wisdom. This comes from the clan O'Mealy, which is my wife's maiden name. You may have heard this before, but the wish is this: may those who love us, love us. And those who don't love us, may God turn their hearts. And if God cannot turn their hearts, then may God turn their ankles so that we might know them by their limping. To be able to easily recognize who loves us and who doesn't, who is invested in our best interest and who is not. Former Senator Daniel Moynihan wrote, "I don't think that there is any point in being Irish if you don't think that the world is going to break your heart eventually. But sooner or later, the things in which we invest all of our heart and all of our being will let us down and will break our hearts. But here's the problem. We will still hold fast to those old ways and go kicking and screaming and resisting the one way that brings about life. In order to get the context for the parable that Jesus tells in chapter 20 of the Gospel of Luke, we need to back up 8 verses and see what happens in the first 8 verses of chapter 20. We are reminded, first of all, that Jesus is now in Jerusalem, the last place of his ministry, and he will conduct the rest of his public ministry in Jerusalem. As Jesus is teaching in the temple, Jesus is approached by the chief priests and their scribes, and he is questioned, and this is the question they put in front of Jesus: by what authority are you doing these things? They were referring, first of all, to the fact that Jesus has come into the temple and he has stirred everything up. He's upset the tables, he's kicked out the money changers, he's preaching and he's teaching. So the question becomes, by what authority are you doing this? Jesus looks at them and he responds with a question. A good rabbi that he is responds to a question with the question, "Tell me about the baptism of John. Was it a human baptism or did it come from God?" Now, the chief priests and the scribes knew that if they said it came from God, then Jesus would be able to say, then why don't you follow John and his teachings? They also knew if they said that John's baptism came from human hands, then the people would revolt because they had great faith in John and his teachings. And so they saw Jesus' question to their question, and they decided not to answer. So what Jesus does in that brilliant moment in answering a question with a question is he determines whether they're willing to listen or not. Are they asking a question because they want to listen to the answer or because they have another agenda? Are they willing to listen? It's a fascinating question, even for us now, as we say, why do we ask questions? I think it was about 6 or 7 years ago, you can probably check this on your iPad at some point, but St. Patrick's Day fell on a Friday. At that point, I was living in the Youngstown, Warren area in Ohio, and it was a very heavily Roman Catholic area. And a problem was created because St. Patrick's Day was on a Friday in Lent. Dare you eat corned beef on a Friday in Lent? Now, people were worked up about that. Television shows were covering the concern of the people. The newspaper had articles on it. And finally, the bishop of the Youngstown Diocese made this statement: "We will give you an exemption to eat corned beef on St. Patrick's Day on a Friday in Lent if you call your parish and talk to your priest and get dispensation." So a good colleague of mine, who was a Roman priest at Blessed Sacrament Church, said after the first 2 hours, he stopped answering the phone because he knew that they were going to call him all day long. But here's the fascinating part about what was happening. They were calling my friend and asking the question, but they were asking the question because they wanted a certain answer. They wanted the priest to say yes. Do we ask our questions because we want to hear the answer, or because we want the answer that we desire to hear? And I think most of the time when we ask questions is because we want the answer to match with where we are in life, to bolster us up, to agree with us, to tell us we're okay, to tell us that we have it right. How many times do you ask a person a question for information, hoping that when they answer the question, they will give you something that you can then point out that they're not doing right? Tell me why you did this. Oh, I see. But don't you realize that that's not the right way to do it? It's a question that parents have whenever we think our children are being ungrateful. And we say, do you realize how much I've done for you today? Now, it's not because we want our children to be thankful at that moment. It's because we want our children to feel sorry for us for everything we've done that day for them. And so the pat answer is, yes, Father, I do realize the sacrifices you have made this day, and I was wrong in taking advantage of those sacrifices, and I duly try to change my life next time. Did it ever happen in your families? No, it doesn't happen in mine either. We want the answer we expect. It's the question politicians ask in front of the television cameras. They don't want an answer that's going to be helpful. They want an answer that's going to lead to them being right and their opponents being wrong. It's the reason why reporters ask questions. They ask questions not to get more information, but to trap the politician. We ask questions not to grow, but in order to find the support we want to stay the way we are. And God forbid we stay in that trap and never grow and never mature. That's the context of the parable. People who aren't willing to listen because the answer upsets their lives. There's a fascinating blocking that happens in this 20th chapter of Luke. Blocking is that practice that people in theater do where they tell where people are going to be on the stage as they engage in the dialogue. And so what you have here is that we have Jesus speaking with the people in the temple in Jerusalem. And he is approached by the chief priests and the elders, who call his attention to them, and they ask that question of him. And then Jesus turns away from them and back to the people. And in doing that, he's telling the people a story that the chief priests and elders are overhearing. And at first they think it's a clever story and they're buying into it, but slowly they realize that while he's looking at the people, he's talking about them. And he tells the story of a vineyard, an image that would be common to them at the time, that comes from the fifth chapter of Isaiah, which Isaiah does this wonderful bit of poetry. It says, "Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. He expected it to yield grapes, but it yielded nothing but wild grapes, grapes of oppression and injustice." It challenges the religious leaders of the time to say, God has given you this blessed gift, and you are abusing it and destroying it and turning against God's very wishes. And so God will bring about your destruction. This is being said to chief priests. Prior to Jesus arriving in Jerusalem, the conversation was with the Pharisees and other religious leaders who were from the synagogue tradition, which allowed a lot of room for lay involvement, and there wasn't this sense of being in a position for life. But when you move to the priests in Jerusalem, you're dealing with people who inherited their position and had their positions for life. And having their positions for life, they assumed that they were right for life. We still offer those kind of positions in our own modern world. It's capturing the essence of the election of a new pope this week. And I'm fascinated by the level of interest that Americans have shown in the election of a new pope. It was on Tuesday that I got a phone call that Deacon Gus wasn't coming in. He claimed that he had a sinus infection and wasn't feeling well, so wouldn't be in the office. But it was on Wednesday afternoon I discovered the real reason why he wasn't there. He had discovered that he was two votes short of being elected pope, and he was gravely disappointed he didn't get it, and he needed a couple days to recover from that blow to his ego. to be religious leader for life, which is part of what really turned the Roman church on its ear when the Pope stepped down before he died. To be given a title and to hold that title and all the power that comes with it for a lifetime is a concept that is opposite of the way we as Lutheran Christians understand our call to ministry. We don't talk about it as a title, but as an office. That when you step into a certain office and you perform the functions of those office, you then are that person. And so you're not a pastor until you step into the office of pastor and perform what pastors do, preaching the word and presiding at the sacraments. You aren't a deacon until you step into the office of deacon and perform the roles of being a deacon. You aren't a choir master for life, but you are as soon as you step in the office when you fulfill the obligations. And when you no longer fill the obligations of the office, you step aside and you don't remain that title for the rest of your life. That's why I'm always troubled when they refer to former governors still as governor. They're not governor anymore. They're not in the office. Former senators as senators. They're not senators anymore. They're not performing the functions as senator. And why that is important is because the trap we have if we think we are in the position for life is that if we are in the position for life, we can't be wrong. And how many of you assume, because of where you are in life and what you have accomplished and what you have done and what you believe means that you are going to be right the rest of your life? Perhaps if you were safer, felt safer enough to be honest, there would be hands that would go up because I would raise mine as well. And what Jesus points out at this moment is that if you don't fulfill the obligations of your calling, God will find someone else who will. It doesn't matter that this congregation is almost 283 years old. The Trinity Church doesn't fill the obligations of its mission. God will find another church that will. That judgment brings terror to the other group that is listening to Jesus' parable, the people to whom Jesus is actually speaking, because at that moment they realize that the religious leaders in whom they have trusted to keep everything in order and make everything work for them will be stripped from their positions. And if they are, what's going to happen to them? Now, here's the irony of that. Isaiah tells us that the outcome of what happens in this vineyard is that it yields wild grapes. And so they engage in acts of injustice and oppression. That in this house, the people of Judah bring injustice. God expects justice but sees bloodshed. God expects righteousness, but hears a cry. That the people are still depending on those who destroy them to save them. There's this wonderful character, and I've used this story before in a novel by P.D. James. It's the witness to a crime who one night is in her bed thinking through the events of the day. And it talks about how next to her bed she has a picture of her father, and she starts remembering what it's like to grow up in childhood with a father who was abusive. She said every day they heard their father coming home from work, she and her brother would hide. And he would seek out one or the other. She said, you would think that as brothers and sisters, if one was being hurt, the other one would feel sorrow. But instead it was a sense of relief that the brother was picked not over her that day. It was fascinating how this character developed this memory, and finally the end, the question became, why does she still have the picture of her father next to her bedside? And James writes this, Her father had done his work well. For she didn't hate him, she loved him. The one that was destroying her is the one that she loved. Onto what are you holding that you think is going to save you? And perhaps don't even realize it's your undoing at this very moment. Is it your pride? Is it your self-righteousness? Is it your confidence or your life story or your history? Is it that you're the most humble person that you know? What is it that you're relying on that you think will save you, but is consuming you right now? It's about being crushed. The brilliance of Luke as a writer is demonstrated in this text when Jesus quotes the line, "The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." Because the word cornerstone here can refer to the cornerstone, which is underneath, but it also can refer to the keystone, which is above. And Luke then develops that to say, anyone who falls on the cornerstone will be broken to pieces. And anyone on whom the keystone falls will be crushed. You're between both stones and being crushed at this moment. That's the cross of Jesus Christ. When it slowly and systematically takes away everything you hold on to save yourself. As Paul says, it's not about his resume, his righteousness, following the rules, being good in the eyes of God and doing God's work. He abandons all of that as rubbish so that he might know the death of Christ, to be crushed between those stones. For only when our rebellious will is crushed between those stones can we die and be brought to a new way of living. And that new way of living is a life that comes from one who is raised from the dead. It is not what we do. It is not the life philosophies we hold on to that we think that are going to make everything make sense. It's not those positions and places we hold in life that we think will always keep us right. It's not even holding on to those things around us that are destroying us. We are saved in only one way, through the grace of God and Jesus Christ, who dies and is risen from the dead. So that in our suffering, we will find new life. Amen.